Welcome to the latest episode of the IA School of Thought series with me, Sai Kamal. This series is based on the IA book, School of Thought, 101 Great Liberal Thinkers, by Eamon Butler, which, as the title suggests, summarises the thoughts of leading classical liberal thinkers on a range of issues and discusses them within a modern context. All the episodes in this series and all our other online content can be found on our YouTube channel, IA London, on Podbean, or on our website, ia.org.uk. Today, we're looking at two thinkers featured in the book who are usually considered together, Richard Cobden and John Bright, co-founders of the Anti-Corn Law League. And to discuss them, I'm delighted to be joined by Robert Colville, Director of the Centre for Policy Studies, Editor-in-Chief of CAPEX, and a Sunday Times columnist. Robert, thank you very much for joining us. Welcome to the programme.
Lovely to be here.
Now, you've chosen two thinkers, rightly so, that Richard Cobden and John Bright are usually thought of as together as opposed to separately. And they're thought of together clearly because they were the co-founders of the Anti-Corn Law League. Now, why did you choose them? Do they have an impact on you specifically? Was it a subject that you've always been historically interested in? Did they inspire you in a particular way or shape your thinking? What was it that made these two gentlemen stand out for you?
Well, so I'm always I'm a sucker for Victorians and Enlightenment thinkers in general. I mean, I think this country and the book by Eamon has an extraordinary heritage of thinkers, and there are so many I could have chosen. I guess I chose Cobden and Bright because they are inspiring figures, but also they are extremely relevant today. The focus on agricultural protectionism, free trade, not just the sort of the importance of free trade, but the morality of free trade, I think speaks very much to where we are as a country. And the other thing which appeals to me about them is that they're not just thinkers, they're doers. They are people who translated things that they believed in very firmly into practical policy. In Cobden's case, not just in terms of the corn laws, but also in terms of getting a trade treaty with France at a time when Palmerston was making speeches denouncing, saying we needed to build fortresses on the coast to defend against the French menace. So they're clearly people who engaged with practical policies, yet at the same time sort of remained pure, as it were. They didn't compromise. They were both sort of steadfast and devout, and I think that's a really interesting tension.
Now, of course, we're looking at these two gentlemen together, John Bright and Richard Cobden. But what do we know about them as individuals? About their background, who inspired them? How they got to a position that they found themselves in?
Well, so Cobden and Bright, for those who aren't familiar with the story, are essentially the parliamentary tribunes of the anti-corn law movement, of the free trade movement. More generally, they are the sort of spokesmen of the rising manufacturing class. They're slightly different figures. Bright comes from a Quaker family. Cobden was a self-made businessman. But they both end up as the representatives of the new industrialists, of the new way of doing things. And come to Parliament with a sort of specific mandate to take on the establishment.
And they clearly had an impact in their lifetimes. We tend to look back at them now as heroes of free trade. But did it take some time for their ideas to gain traction? How did their sort of the way they are viewed change over time from the time that they were politically active, by the time they were successful in their quest, to now?
Yeah. Well, so my sort of personal short handle on this is like Cobden is the man Jeremy Corbyn thinks he is. He was a man who, to a remarkable extent, stayed true to his principles, even though his own reputation suffered. So actually, if you look at Bright, at Cobden, for example, but it applies slightly to Bright as well, there's this enormous swings and roundabouts thing that, like, so when he is campaigning initially, when they are campaigning initially against the corn laws, they are sort of viewed with skepticism and scorn. When that victory is won, they suddenly, they are among the greatest men in England, but are invited to basically sell out and join the establishment and don't do it. But then, Cobden's, the sort of lifelong pacifism, he had this sort of touching and pretty well, actually called quite naive view of that we need to do is give peace a chance. So he was so there was a period when Napoleon Bonaparte gets in and there's a sudden In England, there is a sort of sudden a wave of like, oh my God, there's another Napoleon, and he's the guy saying no. Let's just be friends with them. He is absolutely vilified. And then a few years later, Napoleon III is suddenly our best friend, and it's the Russians we hate, and we're going to war in Crimea. And so suddenly everyone's going, oh, what a far-sighted visionary this guy is. But then in turn, he's also saying, hey, why are we going to war in Crimea anyway? So there's a consistency to their thought and their belief. And, you know, Bright, again, who outlives Cobden by some period, you know, he's on home rule for Ireland. You know, he, again, he sort of stands up to the orthodoxy in his party. So, you know, so there's a real sort of thread of moral principle going through their things, and their reputations fluctuate according to how popular those causes are. But I think today, looking back, you know, they are sort of unimpeachably in the canon.
Yeah, it's interesting what you say about Cobden. I mean, I'm also a professor of politics and international relations, and when I teach students about international relations theories, one of the things that I've been looking at with some other classical liberals is there a particular classical liberal school of international relations and foreign policy? And how would you apply that to, you know, contemporary foreign policy? And when you look back historically at the development of liberalism and how it's become liberal institutionalism, people do look at Cobden, but they dismiss Cobden as being rather naive. That he thought that if you just have trade, that just automatically leads to peace, and that trading nations don't go to war with each other.
Well, you know, the more recent line, you know, until the Serbian crisis, you know, no two countries with a McDonald's had ever gone to war with each other.
Exactly. So it's interesting the impact in that way. Now, how do you think, you know, since the time that they were, well, tell us a bit about the campaign, the Anti-Corn Law League, and, you know, that the way that campaign developed. But also tell us about the way that the view of that, looking back, has changed over time, from their own time to today.
So I think there's obviously an element of self-interest there, that, you know, these guys have convinced themselves that they are in the right, but they are also the representatives of a class who will do very well after this policy change. You know, they will get. You know, they and their allies will tend to get cheap inputs for manufactured goods, but what interests me and what appeals to me is that, like, the arguments they're making. I mean, first of all, the arguments they're making are just very, very well made. Like, Bright is the guy who coins the phrase "Mother of Parliament." He's the guy who coins flogging a dead horse. You know, these are really, you know, they are very, very good at communication. Bright especially. But they have a, you know, that what they sort of bring is a sort of moral argument, that it's a moral and practical argument, that they're not just, it's a development of Adam Smith in some ways. They're not just saying that free trade will bring cheap bread, which is the kind of, or cheap in, you know, cheap goods for manufacturing. They're saying that, you know, that by having free trade, we will force our own agricultural sector to improve. So, you know, it's not a new idea. It is building on what's been said before by other liberal thinkers. But this alliance and the awful coincidence of the Irish famine convinces the most powerful country in the world, which has built its empire on essentially mercantilist protectionism, essentially convinces it for about a century to convert to free trade, and embeds that logic right at the heart of British thinking, and, you know, convinces Peel to break the Tory party in the name of free trade, effectively, which is an extraordinary sort of moment. You know, the sheer power, the power and logic of their arguments convince the Prime Minister, who admittedly is a kind of very rationalist Prime Minister and is quite unpopular with his backbenchers anyway, but they convince him to, you know, that this is right and this needs to be done. And, you know, and then it's not until, like, Joseph Chamberlain, Nick Timothy's idol, there's an effective, and you know, in a time when, like, America and Germany are threatening to take away Britain's preeminence, it's not until then that there's really a challenge to that orthodoxy.
And, you know, people quite often refer to them as sort of the pioneers of the Manchester School of Liberalism. What do you think happened to that school over time?
Well, one of the most depressing things about Britain is that we lost that tradition. You know, we went from a situation, I think, I think the statistic is something like, you know, in 1900, 90 pence in every pound that was spent by government was spent and controlled at a local level. By the time you get to the year 2000, it's 10 pence is spent and controlled by local government. We become, over the course of the 20th century, one of the most, you know, the most over-centralized nations. And it's not obvious to me, or indeed to many people, that was a good move, that's kind of left us any better off. And in fact, you know, the whole levelling up agenda, which we've done work on at the Centre for Policy Studies, is in some ways a welcome and necessary corrective. The localism movement, which I was where I cut my teeth in kind of conservative thinking, direct democracy, that again, that was a sort of reaction to this decentralisation. So we lost that sort of fate. And obviously this was exacerbated by the fact that, you know, our industrial power did winnow, but we lost that idea of sort of proud and resilient and self-sustaining communities, which didn't really need London to tell them what to do, and in fact, you know, of having people in London who were the tribunes of those communities.
Now, you know, as people who are, you and I are clearly sympathetic to classical liberal ideas, we would see both of these gentlemen as heroes of free trade. But when we look back at their other views on other subjects, were they very much men of their time? Would there be things that we would disagree with them looking back? For example, you mentioned the empire. What, do they have specific views on the empire? Or were they still be seen in modern times as having quite enlightened views on issues such as the empire?
I mean, I think of their contemporaries, they would come out quite well. That, you know, their sort of idea of like a, if I, yeah, not like a moral foreign policy, but, you know, they are, you know, I think it was the Palmerston when he tried to, you know, when Palmerston made overtures, I can't remember whether it was Bryce or Cobden, but it was one of them, and I said, look, no, I'm not going to, you know, it would be hypocritical for me to join your government when I don't agree with what you're doing. So, I mean, oddly, you know, I'd favour more muscular on foreign policy. I'm sort of more muscular than that. As you said earlier, I think Cobden in particular was pretty naive in his utopianism. But, you know, it's a nice thing to be. You know, if you're going to err on the side of thinking good of your fellow man.
Yes, and at least he's remembered for good reasons, you know, and free trade. If you like. Now, looking at the way that we look at them today, what do you think are for classical liberals or free market conservatives or others who believe in a free market? What do you think that we can learn from Cobden and Bright? And what do you think they would probably wish that we better understood now?
I think it comes back to that point about morality and about the moral high ground, that they were so good at explaining and advocating what, for, you know, not just why these policies made sort of dry economic sense, but why they were the right thing to do. And I think, you know, one of the problems we've got is, you know, everyone gets so swept up in like arguments about chlorinated chicken and, you know, all the rest of it, that it's just, you know, we've lost that sort of that golden thread. And actually, Boris Johnson kind of gave quite a sort of Cobdenite, like his speech in Greenwich, which I went to on free trade, was, you know, it was very much in that lineage. It was sort of reminding people that this is the idea which has made more people richer than over the last century than pretty much anything else. And it's, you know, it's not only good for us in terms of just cheap inputs, it's good for us because it kind of keeps us on our toes. And, you know, I think that sort of self-confidence, that ability to reason things through, is just something that I really admire in them. And I'd like to see, you know, and I think, you know, if I'd been in it there at the time, I probably disagreed with them on a whole load of things. But just, you know, that integrity, that, you know, I mentioned Corbyn, the sort of parallels with Corbyn and stuff. It's like, you know, what a degraded age we have when the person we think of when we think of an MP who has kept to his, you know, has kept to his principles throughout his parliamentary career is Jeremy Corbyn, who has awful principles, has never thought anything through in his life. You know, Corbyn Wright had brilliant, you know, really much, you know, especially on trade. They got it right, and then they had the courage of their convictions.
You and I are not in the same room at the moment, and one of the reasons for that is because of the lockdown. We're in the, you know, as a result of the pandemic. Do you think that there's anything that they said in their lifetimes that would have been relevant today or we should be looking to? Are there lessons that we could learn from Cobden and Bright about the government's response to the lockdown?
I'm not sure there are so much. I mean, the thinker, like, as I recall, I'm not sure when this is going out, but the thinker who seems to be obsessing everyone at the moment is Mill. So I tweeted a sort of fairly bog standard Mill's harm principle point yesterday, which is like, the liberty that is being infringed by wearing face masks is the liberty not to breathe infectious diseases on other people who in turn have the liberty not to be infected with a potentially fatal disease by you. There are a lot of people who are sort of, this sort of American version, your freedom to swing your fists ends at the point of my nose. It's, I think that's the kind of, the sort of parallel from the Butler book that I've been drawing more recently. But obviously, I think in terms of not so much the lockdown, but the impact of coronavirus more generally, just if it, what I worry about is if it leads us to turn away from free trade, if it leads us to conclude that a sort of a more autarkic approach that in the name of resilience, we basically return to protectionism. I think that is a real danger. And I think, Cobden and Bright and Peel and all the rest of them would have, Gladstone would have stern words for us on that score.
Yes, as you know, my colleague Steve Davies wrote a book about the history and economics of pandemics. And he said one of the trends that you tend to see is a more of a criticism of trade and migration, because pandemics tend to travel along those routes and people tend to become more protectionist and concerned about migration. And that's probably something to be concerned about. And as you say, one of the things we've got to be aware of is when we look back at thinkers, we shouldn't expect them to have answers for everything. Just because Bright and Cobden spoke about free trade doesn't mean they'll be relevant for every single issue today. Robert Colby, it's been fascinating discussing. If I suppose to sum up, if someone was to say to you, I'll ask it now. They say, you've chosen Cobden and Bright. Why in two or three sentences, what is it about them that stands out for you? Sell them to us. What's the elevator pitch? What would you say?
Because they are the most persuasive advocates for one of the best ideas in human history, which is that when we trade freely between people and nations, we are all far better off.
Robert Colville, thank you very much for joining us today. Can I thank you, our viewers and listeners, also for joining us. If you'd like to put more information on our publications, our webinars and our other online content, check out our YouTube channel, IA London, and our podcasts on Podbean. And to help us keep providing free content during these tough times, please do consider making a contribution, no matter how modest, by donating online at ia.org.uk. Thank you for watching or listening today. We hope that you'll join us again soon. And in the meantime, stay safe.